I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. While coronavirus has infected people all over the world in the last several months, and many countries, including the United States, were largely unprepared for the scope and scale of the pandemic, there were scientists and researchers who were sounding the alarm about this deadly pathogen. Our guest science writer, David Quammen, has been writing for years about animal-borne diseases that jump the species barrier to infect humans with frightening consequences. His books include Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, published in 2012. The Chimp and the River, which was about the origins of HIV. He also wrote Ebola, The Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus. We asked David Quammen to join us to talk about the origins of coronavirus, the lack of preparedness for this current pandemic, and what to do to get ready for the next one. And David Quammen, it's been a bunch of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's good to talk with you again, even under these circumstances.
Absolutely. Let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation. They can send us, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can put a comment or question on our Facebook page as well. You know, David, I was thinking about Ebola, HIV, Hanta, bird flu, West Nile, SARS, MERS, and now coronavirus. Why are we dealing with so many zoonotic diseases?
Well, it's because we're coming in contact with wild animals more and more disruptively. There are more of us humans. We're pushing our way into the last remaining diverse ecosystems where these creatures live. And all of those animals carry unique viruses. They carry their own viruses. So when we push against them, when we capture or kill them for food, when we cut down their habitats, we offer these viruses an opportunity, the opportunity to jump across and infect us instead of them. And if a virus manages to do that, it has won the sweepstakes because now it can be one of the most successful viruses in the world, which this particular coronavirus now is.
And I do want to get to that. You're talking about things like, what, urbanization, agriculture. I think there's something like 7.5 billion people in the world. We're just moving into places where animals and viruses have existed.
That's right. 7.7 billion, I think, now. Maybe going
7.7, okay.
To 7.8. Yeah, I mean, we go into tropical forests, we cut down the trees, we build timber camps, we build mining camps. The workers there have to eat something, generally, or at least frequently, they will eat quote-unquote bushmeat, wild animals, exposing themselves, and then if they get exposed and the virus can pass quickly, it goes to other humans, and the worst-case scenario is that it spreads around the world. The less worst-case scenario is that it might cause a terrible outbreak in a particular area, like the Ebola outbreak in West Africa in 2014.
We're talking, though, and I keep going back to this, to a wild animal market. I don't exactly know how big this market is in Wuhan, China. That seems to be the origins, at least, of this pandemic. And from that market, we're seeing its global impact. It's really frightening.
It is frightening, and I saw some of those markets in China when I was researching this book. Sometimes there are government regulations that drive the wild animal trade underground, and sometimes, as recently in Wuhan, the trade has been operating above ground, where wild animals captured from the wild are kept for sale in cages, among other kinds of animals, domestic animals, you know, chickens, ducks, pigs, and these markets can represent a great mixing bowl for viruses, a place where they can jump from a wild animal to a domestic animal, then maybe pick up a couple of mutations and move on and into humans. But in this case, as is starting to become more clear, this particular pandemic may not have begun in or only in that wild animal market. I've been reading a paper recently that shows that of the 41 original cases, only 27 could be directly linked to that market, which leaves 14 cases of the original 41 hospitalized as people who may have picked up the infection somewhere else in Hubei province. But they still picked it up from a wild animal probably a bat, because this virus matches so closely to a virus that is already known from horseshoe bats in Yunnan and Hubei province.
If we're talking about wild animal markets, these are animals to be eaten, correct?
Correct, yes. These are not on sale as pets, or at least most of them aren't. You see reptiles, you might see snakes, turtles, tortoises, frogs, palms, civets, pangolins, bats, yes, other kinds of wild animals, bamboo rats, most of which, or at least some of which, are captured from the wild, and some, such as bamboo rats, are raised in captivity, bred and raised in captivity for the meat trade. I visited a bamboo rat farm also when I was in China, and described that in Spillover.
You wrote an article, it was actually a couple of months ago, but I found it just full of important information that we all should know about, having to do with some research that was done about 1,000 miles away from this Wuhan market in Thailand. Sorry, 1,000 miles away in China, where researchers were looking at these, I guess, bats, what, living in caves. What were they looking for, and what have they found, or what did they find?
Well, they were looking for viruses. They were looking for potentially dangerous viruses. This was work that was done in caves in Yunnan province, as you say, almost 1,000 miles away from the city of Wuhan. This was 5 years ago, and they were finding coronavirus in horseshoe bats in this particular cave. They published a paper, I believe it was published in 2017, describing this virus, alerting people that this could be a dangerous virus. They had the genomic sequence of this virus, and when the new coronavirus, the one we're dealing with now, when that was sequenced in January, they saw that it was almost identical to this virus that they had already identified in horseshoe bats in Yunnan. So scientists have been looking for these things, have been finding these things, have been warning the world about these things. Chinese scientists with international partners, some scientists from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. The warnings have been out there, but they have not been absorbed or heeded or acted upon.
Why don't we take why don't we take scientists' warnings more seriously? What does that tell us?
That's a question that I've been asking myself too, and I've been asking some public health officials. I didn't spend 5 years researching a book on public health, and that was mostly on the ecology and emergence of viruses. But now we're all trying to learn about public health logic and thinking, and so I've asked some of these experts, why were the warnings not heeded? And they tell me variously, well, for instance, it costs a lot of money to take preparations against a possible pandemic. It costs billions of dollars, creating excess hospital capacity, excess capacity of intensive care units, excess capacity of ventilators, personal protective equipment, masks, gowns, et cetera, gloves. It costs money to create massive amounts of excess capacity, and then it's all for something that might happen or might not happen during your presidential term, during the next 4 years, or during your term in office as a governor, whatever. And then if that thing, that bad result doesn't happen, people criticize you. Oh, you spent billions of dollars doing all this preparedness for a pandemic. What pandemic? It didn't happen. So politicians tend to be averse to that kind of risk. But of course, spending billions of dollars on that kind of preparedness is nothing compared to the costs of this thing now.
Well, we're talking,
how do we get around that? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. Obviously, we're talking about trillions of dollars and a lot of misery around the world. Why bats? Why are bats so implicated in the spread of these kinds of diseases?
Well, you're right that bats are implicated in what seems to be more than their fair share of these cases, as the host, the natural host from which these viruses spill over. One reason for that is presumably that bats are a very, very diverse order. of mammals. They are the most diverse order of mammals, period. One in every four species of mammal on the planet is a species of bat.
Wow.
So there are just lots of different kinds of bats, and that's the reason why they might seem to be overly represented, but they probably are overly represented even beyond that for a couple of reasons. Bats can live a long time. A little bat, like a horseshoe bat, which is the size of a mouse, might be able to live 15 or 20 years. A mouse is lucky to live 1 or 2 years. They also congregate in great masses. They roost together in colonial masses. You might see 60,000 little furry bats roosting together on the wall of a cave, you know, three bats deep, and the mothers with the pups at their breasts. So, you know, that's not social distancing. That's a great situation for passing viruses from one individual to another. So living a long time, congregating so closely allows viruses to circulate through their populations. And in addition, there is now some thinking on the part of scientists that bats' immune systems are just fundamentally different. They are downregulated relative to the immune systems of other mammals because bats are the mammals that fly. And flying puts particular stress on their physiology. That physiology may cause the release of DNA from their own cells, naked DNA floating around, and their immune systems would or could react to that naked DNA in a sort of autoimmune response. So it seems that evolution has tuned down their immune systems to be less responsive, to have a higher threshold of detection of alien things, and that could very well allow viruses to circulate in their bodies without being cleared by their immune systems.
I mean, I feel this weird need to defend bats because they also, at least, you know, the ones living around where I live, they also do a lot of good.
Absolutely. Let's take a minute to defend bats here. The conclusion to be drawn from this, that bats carry viruses that could be dangerous to humans, is not, God forbid, that we should kill bats or get rid of bats. Mm-hmm. The conclusion is that we should leave bats alone. As you say, bats are wonderful creatures. They perform important services. They're part of ecosystems. They pollinate some plants. They keep insect populations down. We need bats. We want bats. We should just stay away from them ourselves.
We're almost up in a break here. In fact, let's take a break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We've got some comments coming in. Talking with David Quammen. He's an award-winning science writer, and for years he's been writing about animal-borne diseases that jump the species barrier. They're called zoonotic diseases and infect humans. We are dealing with that right now with the coronavirus pandemic. We're going to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And again, any questions or comments, David's the guy to talk to, or put your question to radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And again, you can leave a comment on our Facebook page as well. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Esco, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm at home, as is our guest, David Quammen. We're talking about the origins of the coronavirus, what we know so far, why we have been so unprepared for this outbreak, and frankly, how to prepare for the next one. Here's an email from George who says, would it be helpful if China outlawed the sale of bats, or are there too many other vectors? Picking up on what you were saying earlier, can you speak to that, David Quammen?
Yes. I think it would certainly be helpful if China shut down the trade in wild animals captured from the wild, bats and other creatures. Bats are not the only kind of animal that can carry new viruses to the human population. I mentioned some of those others, but it would certainly be a start. Nobody can tell China what to do, but there certainly is going to be a lot of international pressure on them. They have closed down these wild animal markets before, as I said, after SARS in 2003. They were closed down for a while, but then they opened back up. And I gather that they have even now opened back up in recent days in Wuhan, that there is some wild animal trading still being done in these markets, and I saw a picture, the traders are now wearing masks. Well, that's not the solution. No. So these things need to be regulated, and it's not the only thing that is bringing viruses close to humans, but it would certainly help.
David, let me read something that you wrote in your book, Spillover. This was 2012. You wrote, viruses face four basic challenges: how to get from one host to another, how to penetrate a cell within that host, how to commandeer the cell's equipment and resources for producing multiple copies itself, and how to get back out of the cell, out of the host, onto the next. Is that the way coronavirus operates, or is there something unique about this particular virus?
No, that's the way coronavirus operates. I think I might have been talking mainly about the influenza virus in that passage, but it's all true for coronavirus, too. A virus is not a cell. A virus is a little package of genetic material wrapped in some protein and some lipids, and it has to get into a cell of a living creature. Animals, plants, bacteria and fungi are all cellular, and they have machinery for producing proteins. And a virus needs to get into a cell and hijack that machinery to create copies of itself, and then get back out of that cell and move on to the next cell. That's the way all viruses must work. A virus sitting on a cafeteria tray, we've been told it might stay there for a day or more, but it can't replicate itself on that cafeteria tray. It just retains its potential. So it has to get into the cells of living creatures. Viruses cannot live in the wild except in living creatures, so that when we find a new virus, for instance, this one, in the human population, we know that it had to come from somewhere. It came from another animal, and then the disease detectives go out and try and figure out which animal it came from and how that particular spillover occurred.
I read that this, from what we know about coronavirus, that it has a high mutation rate. How does that complicate things?
Well, you hear different things about the mutation rate. Even I'm hearing different things. Uh-huh. Coronaviruses generally are said to have relatively high mutation rates. They are what are called single-stranded RNA viruses. That's a fancy term. All it means is that their genome is a single strand of genetic material, and when it copies itself, it can potentially make mistakes in the copying, and that gives mutations, variations, raw material for evolution by natural selection. Now, I should say that coronaviruses don't evolve as quickly as influenza viruses, which are probably the fastest evolving of all viruses, but still coronaviruses can evolve relatively quickly, and that means they can potentially change a bit as they infect one host after another. And the more hosts they affect, the more they have replicated, the more chances for mutations, genetic variation, and therefore the more chances for evolution.
Should we think of viruses as smart or dumb, or is that a dumb question?
It's not a dumb question. People ask that question. Viruses, I guess they're neither smart nor dumb, though. They are enterprising. They have great capacity to survive and to evolve. Let me put it that way. They are formidable as evolutionary entities. They don't have purposes. They don't have intentions. They don't wish us ill. They're not evil. They just have an inbuilt tendency to replicate themselves and survive and evolve by Darwinian natural selection. They have an incredible inbuilt tendency. You might almost call it a will, but again, that's a little bit anthropomorphic. We're smart, they're not, and yet they are still formidable challengers to us.
I want to pick up on that, but we've got a couple of more comments from our listeners. A tweet from Carmel. She says, in terms of preventing zoonotic spillover events, how do we stop the consumption of bushmeat, bats, etc., without the implications of cultural insensitivity or xenophobia? And I'm assuming people who are eating these animals are eating them because they need to survive.
Yeah, and that's a very good question. I'm glad for the opportunity to talk to that question, because it is true that if people are eating bats or pangolins in China, we're quick to criticize that. If in Africa people are eating forest antelope or even elephant meat or chimpanzees, we're very quick to criticize that. If people here in Montana are eating deer and elk, we're less quick to criticize that, at least many people are. In Montana, we call that game, and when people do it in Africa, we call it bushmeat, and there seems to be a negative onus. The critical thing, well, there are several critical things. One is an ethical question of whether humans should eat animals at all, and another is a question of whether humans should eat animals that are endangered. A third question is whether humans should eat primates, because they're so close to us and we're more likely to pick up diseases from them. So there are all these ethical questions that have to be addressed. You can't just say we got to shut down the bushmeat trade because people in Africa, many of them depend on bushmeat for their protein. They're desperate for protein. In China, I think that's not so much the case. There is a vogue for wild animal meat in China. Some people say, well, this is an ancient tradition, but a colleague of mine has written an op-ed, a Chinese fellow that I know has written an op-ed in the New York Times. He went back to the Chinese sources, and the ancient Chinese sources, and he found evidence that these sources were saying, no, don't eat wild animal meat. It's not good for you. He suggested strongly that it's not really an ancient tradition in China. It is just perceived to be an ancient tradition, and that has given us a certain vogue now. So all of these things are there. There are issues of cultural sensitivity, there are issues of moral boundaries, and there are issues of people needing food. They all need to be taken seriously and looked at in their particulars.
And that's science writer David Quammen. We are talking about the coronavirus pandemic, some of the origins of this virus, obviously the impacts and what we should do looking ahead, because these pandemics look like they are becoming more frequent. And again, he's written a bunch of books, I think about a dozen of them, one including Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, actually published in 2012. Here's an email from Christine. She says, centuries ago, when humans live closer to nature, did epidemics like this break out? Do we know that, David?
Yeah, we know that for sure. Think of the 14th century, bubonic plague, killing possibly one-third of the population of Europe. That was a zoonotic disease. Bubonic plague still is a zoonotic disease. It's caused not by a virus, but by a bacterium. That bacterium is carried in fleas that live on rats. When you have a lot of rats in your city or your environment, there is more chance that the fleas will jump off a rat and jump onto you and give you bubonic plague. In Thucydides, there was talk of the plague of Athens. We don't know exactly what caused that. I think they speculate maybe typhoid or typhus. Zoonotic diseases, they have been with us. They have been influencing battles and movements of civilizations in the course of history for thousands of years. But now, because, as we've said, there are so many of us, 7.7 billion humans, and we're coming into contact more and more with wild animals and pushing them in their ecosystems, we are probably triggering more of these spillovers and therefore higher potential for pandemics and plague. Also because we're so interconnected now. We're flying around the planet and viruses can fly with us.
Also, something that you have said numerous times about us human beings is that we are animals, like the animals that we have been talking about. Mm-hmm. And essentially, we're dependent, yep. We're interdependent, we're all interconnected. And frankly, we are all in this together. I mean, if there's maybe there's more than one silver lining, is that if we could learn this lesson, perhaps we could deal with whatever's coming next.
Yeah, that's right, Marty. That's absolutely true and important. Animal infections, human infections, same infections. Usually I'm careful to say these things don't come to us from animals. They come to us from non-human animals because, as you say, we are animals. We learned that from Charles Darwin, among others, and we need to remember it. That's why bat viruses and chimpanzee viruses have a good chance of taking hold in humans because we're quite similar to them. And this is, as you say, maybe the silver lining. This is a reminder of that. This horrible event, whether it becomes disastrous beyond imagining in terms of loss of human life and misery, or whether we get it under control relatively soon, has the potential to encourage us or force us to do a real reset in the way we think about the natural world and our impacts on the natural world, our demands on the natural world. I hope that comes out of this.
And that's David Quammen. He's our guest for about the next 7 or 8 minutes. We are talking about what we know about coronavirus and what we should do to address this pandemic and any future pandemic that could be coming our way. And again, you can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and always leave a comment or question on our Facebook page. This is a more political question, but, when there is a crisis, we have government leaders, we have the CDC, we've got institutions who are supposed to help address this crisis. If the U.S. had been more proactive in January, maybe an unfair question, would we be in the situation we are now where something like 200 million Americans have been told to stay home?
Yeah, well, as I've said, public health is not the area of my expertise, but we're all citizens and we're all entitled to have opinions and views on this. Yeah, I think the answer to your question is yes, definitely. If we had been better prepared in January, then this would not be so bad now. If we had great readiness in terms of the ability to produce effective test kits in the necessary numbers and get them around and do contact tracing of every identified case and ask people to self-quarantine if they had been merely a contact of an infected person. If we had been able to do all the things that can be done, we would be in a much better situation now.
Is it too late? I mean, are we obviously we're in a crisis mode, but do you have hope that if people can social distance and we can do what we are supposed to do, that we can get this thing under control?
Yes, I do have hope. Definitely, I have hope that the things that we are being told by the best of our advisors, our leaders, people like Tony Fauci and Deborah Birx, and others, if we do what is being suggested, if we stay home, if we social distance, if we give all the support that's possible to the production of the materiel that's needed by our healthcare workers, then we can reduce this from a horrible outcome to merely an awful outcome. And that's a big difference. I think all these things that we're doing now, I mean, it's too late to prevent this thing from spreading all throughout the U.S. There are places like Montana, which doesn't have too many cases yet, although most of them are in the town where I live, Bozeman, places in the South and the West that haven't seen a whole lot of confirmed cases yet. We've got to assume that the virus is already there. It's already circulating in a lot of places where we don't know about it yet. So it's too late to stop it, but we can control it. We can thin it out. We can flatten the curve. We've all heard that phrase, so that the avalanche of cases doesn't overwhelm our medical system the way it's about to do in New York. The loss of life isn't worse than it might be. Yes, everything we do now can make a big difference.
I know so many people, I'm sure you do as well, who are afraid. And I mean, they're depending on what mood you catch me in or what time of day or what's on the news, You know, I am fearful as well. I know you're not a psychologist, but you know, you've been thinking about these pandemics for such a long time. How do you deal with this? How do you deal with this crisis that we're
well,
in?
Well, it is a fearful situation, and I sympathize deeply with that feeling of people. There are people who are losing sleep. There are people who are having real emotional problems. I'm sure it's difficult. When I first started learning about these emerging viruses, they were very, very spooky to me, and Ebola was the one that I looked at first, and then I got interested in the ecology and evolutionary biology of Ebola and, by extension, these other viruses. They are these little sort of semi-mechanical, semi-living creatures. They're not evil. They're not preternatural. They are simply very dangerous. That helped me a little bit. I don't think that's something that I can necessarily expect from other people, because they're not going to spend their time reading about the ecology and evolutionary biology of these things. But still, the fear, we have to deal with the fear. I think one of the things we need to do is remember that social distancing need not and should not involve emotional distancing. We need to stay connected with one another by radio, by Skype, by Zoom, by Facebook. When you walk down the street, and you know, I walk down the street in Montana in this little town, I see somebody coming, and I cross the street so that I don't pass that person on the sidewalk. And yet, I make eye contact and I wave a friendly hello to that person just to signal we're all in this together, and we need to remember that. We need to stay emotionally connected even while we're socially distanced.
Well, it's been such a pleasure and so helpful to talk to you, David Quammen. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Marty, thank you. Good to talk with you, and thank you for taking the time. Stay safe. Everybody,
yeah,
stay safe.
You too.
We'll get through this.
Yeah, thanks so much. That's science writer David Quammen. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be talking about what it will take to end this crisis, talking with epidemiologist Jennifer Nuzzo. That's coming up next. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. More than 250 million Americans have been ordered by their mayors and governors to stay home as coronavirus continues to infect and kill its victims in many parts of the country. The emergency has been extended to the end of April. Dr. Deborah Birx, coordinator of the White House Coronavirus Response Team, revealed this week that if social distancing guidelines are followed perfectly, and we know that they are not, we can expect between 100 to 200,000 coronavirus-related deaths. That is a best-case scenario. The U.S. has the highest number of reported coronavirus infections in the world, and we know that that's an undercount since we don't have an adequate testing system, at least not yet. We asked Jennifer Nuzzo to join us once again. She's a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, also associate professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and she directs the Outbreak Observatory, conducting research to improve outbreak preparedness and response. And Jennifer Nuzzo, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, again, to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment or question on our Facebook page. Jennifer, this emergency has been extended to the end of April. What should we do, all of us, in the next month to slow bend this curve, to really make a difference?
Yeah, I mean, this is really an urgent time. We are seeing cities that have been very hard hit, where the health systems are near capacity, potentially going to be overwhelmed. So it's critically important that people help try to slow the spread of this illness by staying home and not going out unless it's absolutely essential. Really try to limit your contact with others, and even in the home, you know, wash hands, use the kind of cough and sneeze hygiene that you hope and that you've been told about, and you know, wipe down surfaces after you do that.
I was hearing more and more people that maybe a couple of weeks ago were saying, you know, face masks really should only be for people who are dealing with patients. But now I'm hearing more and more public health people say we should all be wearing face masks when we go out in public. Do you have a position on that?
Yeah, you know, it's a tricky one. We don't actually have data, really, to tell us what to do here. First of all, there are not enough face masks. Wow. So absolutely the priority is that it has to go to medical workers, above all. And we certainly don't want to recommend anything that would divert face masks from medical workers. None of us will be safe if doctors and nurses can't do their jobs safely, and that will require having masks. That said, some people are looking into the possibility of cloth masks and making cloth masks to wear. I think the thought is that perhaps they could prevent larger droplets, and those are things like when people sneeze or cough, from getting into your nose and mouth. But it's nothing that's really been studied. We don't really know anything about cloth face masks. One of the things that I'm personally concerned about is that they tend to retain moisture. And, you know, if you touch a contaminated surface and then touch the mask and then you touch the mask later and touch your face or nose or eyes, you could contaminate yourselves. That said, clearly people are trying to find a way, better way to protect us. And that's why I think you're hearing a lot of recommendations about masks. It's just from, as an epidemiologist, I don't see a lot of data to make me say, yes, go out and do this. And I do sort of worry about these other risks.
Well, so the idea is, I mean, to stay home as much as possible, to keep that at least 6 feet between you and somebody else. It's hard to do that in the supermarket, I will say. But that, I mean, just something simple, basic, and important to keep in mind.
Absolutely.
I mentioned Dr. Birx, also Dr. Fauci, predicting that, you know, in a best-case scenario, we're talking about 100,000 to 200,000 deaths from coronavirus. I looked up a couple of statistics. Traffic fatalities in 2018, 40,000. Gun-related deaths, 33,000 in recent years. The Second World War was 400,000. The Vietnam War was 50,000. These are really scary numbers.
They are really scary numbers, but they're also just projections, and they're projections on early numbers. And early numbers are not always right, and early numbers actually can change. And I think that's one thing to keep in mind. Although we don't have a vaccine for this, there are studies underway looking at various medicines that potentially could be used to treat people with this infection. And if those work out, they will likely be available more quickly than a vaccine, and so that can be an important intervention. Similarly, just regular supportive health care is, you know, 99% of the people who get this, you know, high percentage of the people who get this will be able to survive. And for those who do require care, you know, some medical support may be helpful. And that's absolutely why they're telling people to stay home now, because we want to make sure that hospitals have the resources to provide care for the people who absolutely need it. And so I believe that these projections, the arcs that we're on, are changeable with our behavior and potentially some of the other tools that may be brought on.
And just to make sure our listeners and myself understand, I mean, the goal for what we're doing is to protect our healthcare system. Is that correct? And the people who work there.
Yes, absolutely. These social distancing measures, I mean, as much as they're important, they are not a cure for this pandemic. They are not going to end the pandemic by themselves. They're very much essentially a pause button. What we're trying to do is slow the number of cases that occur on any one day or in a week so that we can reduce the stress, the strain, and the demand on the health system so that they can see the patients who absolutely need it and provide the level of care that may benefit them. And unfortunately, when you kind of hit pause, that doesn't end the pandemic. It potentially stretches it out over time. But it's hoped that maybe there'll be some new tools that'll come online, or at the very least that we can get our case numbers down to the point where we can do more tried and true public health interventions, like finding cases, isolating them so that they don't pass their infection on to others, finding who they may have exposed while they were infectious, monitoring those individuals, and so that if they do become cases themselves, that they too can be isolated. And those sorts of measures are going to be really essential in the next phase as we think about trying to release some of our social distancing measures, we are going to have to do that more completely than we're able to do now. And the reason why we're not able to do that completely now is just the case numbers are too high for public health authorities to engage in that work.
I mean, in many ways, it comes down to testing. I mean, to tell us who, I guess, tests positive, and I guess you could, you know, extrapolate a number of lessons from that particular person. But how critical is it that we have tests, we have the people who can evaluate them, and then we can get results in a matter of minutes, if not, you know, an hour or two?
Yeah, so testing, unfortunately, has been quite limited, but it is an important tool that we will absolutely have to rely on in terms of trying to get out of this pandemic. That said, right now we're dealing with a situation where there is just insufficient testing capacity. Right. And it's not just about the labs anymore. Public health laboratories now are all able to do the tests. Initially, that wasn't the case. But there are still rate-limiting steps, like we don't have enough of the swabs that they use to collect a specimen to send to the laboratories. The doctors and nurses don't have enough masks to wear in order to collect a specimen to send to a laboratory. So right now, there are still shortages in how many tests that we can do, which is why health authorities in a number of places, particularly the hard-hit places, have been stressing to people that if you are not severely ill, don't come hoping to be tested, because we really have to prioritize those for whom knowing whether they have the disease or not is critical for their treatment. That sounds a little bit contrary when you hear people making calls for we need to increase testing and we need to increase testing. We very much need to do that, but we still need a plan for how to do that, and we need to do that in a way that doesn't put additional strain on the health system.
We hear governors, Cuomo is the most obvious one that comes to mind, who are, you know, calling for some of the supplies that you mentioned, calling for medical personnel to come and help them out. And it does feel, and some of these governors have said, look, we end up having to compete with each other for these needed supplies. How can we better, I guess, nationalize what's going on from state to state?
Yeah, I think this is utterly critical. I think we are a country of 50 states and territories and District of Columbia. We should not be in a situation where individual states or territories or D.C. are competing with each other for supplies. I mean, what is our union if we can't all work together on this? And I really think it requires more leadership at the national level to visualize the supply chain, understand where resources are, where resources need to go, to try to expand the supply chain, working with companies directly. I mean, companies don't want to be hearing from 50 states individually. It'd be much better if there were kind of one point of contact in the federal government to be negotiating this. And I know efforts are underway, but it's not happening nearly fast enough, because we can't leave our doctors and nurses unprotected.
We posted an article on our Facebook page that you wrote for Politico speaking exactly to that. And you're saying we need to get the Defense Department involved. The CDC, you know, I guess, has to be more involved, HHS, that there are government agencies whose job it is to address a crisis like this.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I think the states are really, you know, leaning in, because they have to protect the people that live within their borders, and that's utterly essential. But I don't believe that a state-by-state approach is what is needed here. I mean, first of all, we don't have a state-by-state economy. We have a national economy. It's actually a global economy, but we need a solution that works across all states, because we can't have a situation where one state is doing okay and its neighbors aren't. Inevitably, that state is going to be affected by that. So we need stronger national leadership on this point. And with respect to the supply chain and masks and everything else that we need, we have never been in a situation before where every country on the planet is trying to get the exact same things. So this isn't just a case where a hospital then can go try to find another supplier, or a state can go try to find another company. This is something that's going to require national leadership. And other countries are using their departments of defense, their ministries of defense, their intelligence services to try to acquire these materials. I don't know why we wouldn't elevate this to that level.
Here's an email from Christian, who says, why does it take so long to create antidotes to these viruses? I was talking with David Quammen about coronavirus and other viruses that have created havoc in various parts of the world. But why does it take so long to get an antidote? Do you know the answer to that?
Well, so, I mean, assuming we're talking about a vaccine, and the same is true for medicines as well, is that we have to study it to understand whether what compound we think may help is, in fact, both safe and effective. You don't want a product that hasn't been demonstrated to be both safe and effective. And unfortunately, it takes time to plan those studies, to recruit people to be in those studies, to obtain results. I mean, we just, in the case of a vaccine, you actually have to see that somebody has a response to the vaccine and collect those data. So all of that takes time. And that's all assuming the science works in our favor, that the compounds that we identify wind up being, you know, safe and effective. And if they're not, then you basically have to, you know, abandon that and go on to something else. But that's to get to the point where we have discovered what is going to work. And then there's an additional time frame that we actually haven't even accounted for in the estimates of we'll have a vaccine in 12 to 18 months, which is that once we find something that works, we then have to manufacture it and we have to make it at scale. And that we don't have vaccine plants that are just sitting around waiting for a coronavirus vaccine. This is something that's highly specialized that we have to plan for, potentially even build new facilities. So that's an enormous investment of time and resources that we have to also account for in our timelines.
Is there a risk of lifting these self-isolation orders? I mean, everyone is really kind of stir-crazy staying at home and, you know, trying to manage work. Or if you're out of work, you've got a whole other set of problems on your hands. So, and we know the president and others, they want to get people back to work for, I think, very obvious reasons. But is there a risk that if we lift this, we'll be back in the soup again?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really difficult situation. I mean, I fall in the firmly in the camp that what we're doing now is utterly essential, but I also realize that this is not sustainable for us. I mean, we need a next phase. I think it's incredibly difficult on people to stay home, to not be connected to each other, to not go about our lives and work in our jobs. And I mean, there are enormous hardships that we are experiencing despite the fact that we need to do this. So we absolutely need to figure out what the next phase is. However, there is a very grave risk that if we lift this too early, we could be right back where we started, which I would hate to sit at home for weeks, months, however long it's going to take, and have it all be for naught. So it's critically important that we figure out what the next phase is. And like I said before, it's not going to end just with these social distancing measures. The virus will still be around, and we need a plan to suppress it as it starts to pop up again in people, and make sure that we don't let the case numbers accelerate like where we find ourselves back in the situation we're in now.
I was reading something, and we're almost out of time here in preparation for the show, where an epidemiological approach, there was the sledgehammer approach where you've got physical distancing, which is what we're doing now, versus a scalpel approach, which is that you target people that you believe have the disease and then let other, you know, those who seem less at risk or not at risk at all to go back to their life. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, I think we're going to need a more nuanced approach. I mean, I think right now the situation was so rapidly accelerating out of control that we had to use a sledgehammer to hit pause. But in terms of reopening and going back to life, it can't be all at once. It will probably have to require some nuance. And, you know, I think there are some groups of people that are particularly at risk for developing severe disease and death. And although severe disease and death can affect anyone, regardless of your age or health condition, there are still groups that are particularly at risk. And so I think going forward, we'll absolutely need to protect individuals living in long-term care facilities. And then we'll have to examine who else, you know, may be able to more safely go out and about.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times, giving us a lot of really important information. Jennifer Nuzzo, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Welcome. You too. Senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to WHYY.org to find more about the program. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Aarons, and Kelsey Hansen. I couldn't do it without them. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.